Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Governor Chris Sununu delivers his first State of the State address. EPA head Scott Pruitt makes an unannounced trip to New Hampshire. And an executive counselor says the state liquor commission is turning a blind eye to illegal cash transactions and is calling for an outside investigation. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. You can call into the Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And we are also streaming a live video of this radio show, so it is very easy to listen and watch. Check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and NHPR's Lauren Chulgin. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
Good morning, thank you. Here.
So we are going to start the show talking about the governor's State of the State address, and we want to hear from you, dear listener. How do you feel about the governor's speech and about what he had to say? What were you hoping the governor would say, and did you hear him say it? Again, the phone number to join the conversation is 1-800-892-6477. And we'll start with you, Lauren Chulgin. First time you were here for the full hour for the weekly news roundup, I believe. So welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And you were at the State of the State speech yesterday. I was there as well. You were talking to a variety of people there. And you reported that the governor seemed to be having a really good time during the speech.
I'm glad you brought that up to start because, like you mentioned, this is my first year here at NHPR. And so this was my first State of the State. And the thing that really struck me from the beginning of his speech was he just looks like he's having a killer time up there. I mean, he just could not enjoy his job more from the, 25 or so minutes that we saw him yesterday, which is really, I think, a telling sign about him, but also about his style of governing. You know, I just was covering politics in Illinois where the governor there, really struggles to be casual or kind of personable and would drop his G's when giving big speeches like that to look more casual.
Like intentionally, like I need to drop my G's during the speech.
Okay. Yes. And yet here we have Chris Sununu who's just smiling from ear to ear, having a grand old time and making jokes and even egging on some people in the audience when they would applaud for him. Even one time, only one person applauded and he was like, thank you so much. Keep it going. So that was one thing that struck me. But on a more policy or, a hard news kind of vibe, I guess you could say, is that we didn't really get a lot of really hard policy ideas, right? It was mostly a lot of platitudes, kind of a victory lap about his first year in office, but only a couple handful of new initiatives on small things, like a robotics competition where kids can win scholarships. And then there was, I know you covered this, Peter, the executive order about veterans that will streamline some veteran services. So on the whole, we did hear a lot of, I've done a good job. I'm happy here. The state looks great. Not a lot of real specifics.
Yeah, we're going to unpack this whole speech in the course of this hour. So stay with us for that. If you have questions or comments, email exchange@nhpr.org. Touching on one of the things you mentioned, Laura, the new initiative, the Governor's Cup, which he said he did not name, not his choice for name, but he's very proud of the program nonetheless. He announced this new initiative supporting STEM education, and students in the state will compete in an annual robotics competition for college credit and scholarships. Here's what he had to say.
We need to signal to the budding engineers, to the scientists, to the kids who want to explore math and technology, that their passion is a priority that we share. And programs like these build upon what we know right now is a world-class public education system in the state of New Hampshire.
And the governor quoted Dean Kamen, who is big on robotics and education, that the kids don't build the robots build the kids. Paul, what you think of that?
Yeah, no, it was a great line. Having Dean there was very important. It was a good symbolic move. Of course, the governor, remember, he was an engineer growing up, went to MIT, so it's in his blood. picking up on what Lauren was talking about, listen, I've been covering Chris Sununu since he was running for governor back in 2015. If you get to spend some time with Chris Sununu on the campaign trail, Lauren was absolutely right. This is Chris Sununu. He's a very off-the-cuff, very conversational kind of guy. It was a very entertaining speech. In fact, you know, State Senator Dan Innes, the Republican from the Seacoast, said, I asked him, what do you think about the speech? He said it was Governor Sununu all the way. He's such an upbeat and positive person, and his attitude is infectious. Now, that's all true, but what do the Democrats have to say? Martha Fuller Clark, another state senator, she said, listen, it was quite slick, it was entertaining, high on performance, but low on substance. And that's what the Democrats are criticizing. You didn't hear a lot, especially on Medicaid expansion. They were very disappointed they didn't get details there.
And let's hear from Democratic Senator Donna Susie, who represents both Manchester and Litchfield. She commented on the governor's statement on the opioid crisis.
Certainly being from Manchester, the opioid crisis is something I was expecting to hear a lot more specifics from today, and I thought the governor's statements were a little short in that regard. We have done a lot of work, but there's a lot more that we need to do.
We're hearing from Democrats who are saying short on policy specifics. Lauren, that's what you're hearing as well?
Yeah, that was kind of the—I would say they all kind of pushed that narrative. And, of course, I mean, you're not surprised that Democrats weren't thrilled with the speech and they weren't, you know, clamoring to get up and applaud at everything that the governor was saying. But the opioid crisis and also, you know, as Paul was saying, Medicaid expansion, I think everybody was kind of listening for that. And the governor really just slightly mentioned it, says that there are slight differences between people, but we'll get it done. There wasn't any details about what that plan will look like. It was more of like a turning point in his speech to talk about something else.
Well, Dean, let me ask you, do State of the State speeches generally have a lot of policy specifics, or do governors tend to gloss over the high points of their past year?
You typically get the most programmatic discussion in a budget address that we get every 2 years. But yes, these State of the State addresses can be fairly programmatic. If you think of akin to a State of the Union address, some governors will list a sort of fairly clear set of priorities. And as we've already been discussing, Governor Sununu tends to be a bit more extemporaneous. You remember his speech he gave last year was quite extemporaneous. He took a page out of the State of the Union address, and he had the gallery populated with a variety of individuals that he could point to tell stories. In fact, he wove the idea of stories and narrative throughout the speech. He began, I mean, I think in a sense, as Lauren, I think Lauren said that this was a bit of a victory lap. He began by saying, you're welcome. Now, he meant that specifically in terms of preventing the toll hike, but I think that that was kind of a nice metaphor for his speech. And, you know, he tends to be a little bit all over the map. It's not really kind of this clear ideological program that he lays out, but I think that has served him well politically. We've seen he's been a very quick learner in office. He's figured out how to triangulate with independents and moderates and conservatives. So, you know, he talked about things like homelessness and civil rights and mental health and child care. But at the same time, he talked about school choice, which is a very conservative idea. So I think that has served him well. It's allowed him to put a little space between himself and Donald Trump, who's much less popular. I think the latest UNH poll had Sununu at about 61 and Trump at about 35, although in fairness, Trump's popularity is very high among Republicans. So it's pretty much what I expected from him. He does seem to be having a good time. That's just kind of he's very strong with the sort of cheerleader or mascot component of being governor. All governors have to figure out how to be sort of the head cheerleader or the head proponent of the state. And he's quite good at that role, and he seems to genuinely enjoy it.
And
let me pick up where Dean left off. It is a campaign year. Remember, Chris Sununu, the first Republican governor in this state in a dozen years. It's been that long since Craig Benson was in the corner office. This speech in many ways was kind of starting, in many ways was setting up his reelection campaign this year. And he does have great poll numbers, 61%, as you said, in that UNH survey that came out. He's in the upper 50s elsewhere. So if you're a Republican, you're going to love this speech. If you were a Democrat, you're going to say, yeah, I can agree on some things, but show me, you know, where's the beef? Where's the beef? So expected in an election year.
Lauren.
It is already election year, isn't it? I mean, it really
Bring
did
it
feel
on.
Like that.
Love it.
So as soon as the speech is over and we all kind of ran down to where the Democrats were giving their response, that was obviously on their mind. You know, Jeff Woodburn had tried, when asked about the election, had tried to peg Governor Sununu to Donald Trump by saying that, you know, he failed to pass some really significant reforms like right to work last year. So I feel like that's what we're going to be hearing out of the Democratic side as, you know,
yeah,
as soon as yesterday.
If you follow Democratic Party Twitter feed.
It was active yesterday.
But just in general, as a rule, they sort of are relentlessly trying to tie him to Trump. And right now, I think that's a difficult thing for them to do. We'll see what happens, what kind of energy there is in November. if there's enough Democratic energy, he may be in trouble. But for first-term governor, he seems to be in a really reasonably good position for re-election, and also has been quite successful as creating daylight between himself and Trump on a number of issues.
On a number of issues, true. But listen, he just tweeted this week that, guess what? Vice President Mike Pence is coming up here next month to headline a big fundraiser. So, you know, the Democrats will continue to do this. Whether it's effective or not, we'll find out in November.
But I will say the poll that you guys are talking about, also really interesting from that, was that independents, 71% of independents support the governor.
That's a big jump.
That's a really big jump. And also really interesting as he tries to straddle this, you know, what do I do with Donald Trump? How much do I link myself to the White House? How much do I work with them, but also distance myself from them? And I know they say don't read the comments on stories, but one of the comments on our news story lately came from a Democrat who said he's been pleasantly surprised by the governor because he's been pragmatic and non-ideological, and that he's not as far right as other Republicans could be. So maybe it's working for him. The polls show it is, but, you know, we still have some time.
And we got a call from David and Keene, who wanted to pass along his desire that the governor talk about voting and election issues. And I mean, over the past year, that's been such a hot debate, right? And I don't know if we have an answer to that, but does anybody want to respond to the idea that the governor left election issues out?
Well, my sense is he wants it to go away. He had his initial comments in the election about people being bussed into New Hampshire. He backed away from that. He was uncomfortable with the whole voter fraud voter integrity commission with Trump. And so, and then there was an additional attempt with defining the residency for voters. And he had said he didn't foresee any additional changes. He basically wants the issue to just sort of settle down.
Terrible news out of Florida this week. Everybody's talking about gun control now, but Governor Sununu didn't talk about that, but he did talk about school safety. Given the shooting in Florida, it's a worthwhile subject. And here's what he said. Sununu highlighted his support for a new public school infrastructure fund, which he said is investing nearly $20 million toward overdue infrastructure and security upgrades.
For example, we provided funding directly to the Berlin Public Schools to secure the main entrance of the high school and the preschool program. In Salem, the middle school will now have exterior door card readers installed at the side and the rear entrances of their building. And in Dover, a new surveillance system will allow the school's main office to monitor all points of entry and the playground area. In the end, close to 300 schools across the state will receive security funding grants.
Paul, what do you make of this?
Of course, he had to say something about school shooting. I mean, it is the national story right now, by far. Did we expect him to say something about gun control efforts? No. Remember, this is the governor who, in the first bill he signed into law last year was the concealed carry, which Democrats have been pointing out nonstop since his speech. But, you know, listen, these efforts that he's made on school safety are important, so give him some credit for that. But Democrats say he did not go far enough at all on that issue. And one other issue he didn't mention, some Seacoast people are a little disappointed, is he didn't talk about the environment and clean water. Water, a huge issue on the seacoast, but also in other parts of the state.
Listeners, keep in mind that later in the program, we're going to be talking about Senate Bill 500, which aimed to bring some state laws about guns in line with federal law. If you have questions or comments about that or about any other story that you heard this week, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We would like to bring you into the conversation when that conversation starts. You can also send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Governor Sununu was pretty happy about the economy, and he was happy to tout that he had cut significant regulations that in his view were impeding the growth of business in New Hampshire. Here's what he had to say about that.
When I took office last year, we were one of the most overregulated states in the country, not quite the live free or die spirit a lot of us embrace. Therefore, I initiated a three-phase approach to regulatory reform and deregulation. Last summer, as part of phase one, we took 1,600 rules and regulations and wiped them right off the books through an executive order.
An applause line for him there. I spoke with Senator Dan Feltes, a Democrat, yesterday about that line, and Senator Feltes said that a lot of those regulations just weren't being enforced anyway, so the the regulations that he claims to cut pretty much null. Paul, is that, what do you think?
No, Feltus has a valid point there, but this has been a big push by the governor last year, and it's continuing this year in the State House. And one of the reasons he spent a decent amount of time on regulations was he's got another bill he's pushing right now with state lawmakers that will continue this push. It's part of, let's say, his salesman job as he runs for re-election.
Well, it's also part of the GOP agenda in general. It echoes mm-hmm. what's going on in Washington. You know, some people say that Trump has been most successful in within the bureaucracy, repealing and rolling back regulations. And this is, I think, part of that larger attempt by Republicans and conservatives in particular to decrease the size of the bureaucracy. But it is true, you know, you can count these regulations in a number of different ways, and you don't necessarily know what the actual impact of them is. But it's a good kind of marketing point.
Lauren.
See, the only thing I would add about that is, if you're a voter, I mean, how do you wrap your head around regulations? It seems to me to be a really interesting campaign or you know, thing to push when, you know, your regular average everyday New Hampshire. Unless you're a business owner, I mean, how much do you come into contact with certain big state regulations? That's my only question about that.
It's been part of the governor's push to say, hey, we are open for business here in New Hampshire, the New Hampshire advantage, you know, lowering the business taxes and also reducing regulations. He says brings in more business. He says brings in more jobs. That's his strategy. Whether it's effective or not, again, we'll find out in November when he's up for election.
And a governor or a president, for that matter, can certainly find individuals with interesting stories to show how a particular regulation right. prevented them from hiring more people or expanding their business or something like that. And I think that's how you make it relatable on a right. campaign trail.
Well, I would love to hear from a business owner out in New Hampshire right now who knows of a specific regulation.
Call in.
Please do. That's yes, please do call in. If there was a regulation that was wiped from the books that enabled you to grow your business and hire more people or otherwise benefit the state, please give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. Tell us how that the erasure of that regulation helped you. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Governor Sununu spent some time talking about the state's military veterans and military families yesterday. He emphasized his work with the VA last year, and he promised to sign an executive order later in the day.
This legislature took on my call to create a single entity in New Hampshire that could give veterans a stronger voice and better access to services. Unfortunately, while the bill fell short, I have confidence the legislature will return next session to find a better solution. But in the meantime, I don't believe our veterans can simply wait and hope. Therefore, this afternoon, I will sign an executive order that will continue to expand the Fort New Hampshire concepts. My efforts will bring coordinated veteran services under one roof in New Hampshire, while putting resources together to streamline services for one simple goal: better outcomes for our veterans.
Governor promising better outcomes for veterans. Lauren, your reaction?
Well, this is an easy one, right, for everybody in the room. There's everybody, Democrats, Republicans, you know, they're all for protecting veterans and making sure that they're getting the services they need. I like that he also kind of got Democrats to clap sort of about Ronald Reagan, because he quoted Ronald Reagan and then was about heroes. And then was like, our veterans are our heroes. So then everyone's clapping for veterans.
Right.
So in that sense, you know, this is something that everyone can get behind. And even when we talked to Democrats about this afterward, Steve Shurtleff, you know, all he had to say was, I'm a veteran. I'm glad that the state has always been helping out veterans.
This is such an important issue, though. In New Hampshire, we have the highest percentage of veterans of any state in the country, I think, per capita. And we all know the history of the problems we've had at the VA at Manchester, the VA facility. So this is an issue that hits home. And yeah, it's a bipartisan issue to most degrees.
We are, I should correct you, Paul, we are close to being the top, but we are not exactly the top in terms of,
what state did I slight? I'm sorry.
There might be 12 states. I can't exactly remember where we are, but we're close to the top of the pack. We're not quite the top yet, though. Not to say that we don't have a lot of veterans here in the state. And I did see on Twitter regarding this from Representative Brendan Finney, who is, I believe he's a libertarian, and he was a little upset that the governor sort of took this out of the House's hands. The House had tried to pass a Department of Veterans and Military Affairs bill that would have created a commissioner position, spent a ton of money. That was tabled for further study. The House, Brendan Finney was upset that he sort of preempted the House. But the House may return to it, as the governor alluded to in his quote, so we'll see what happens with that. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here with Dean Spiliotis, Lauren Chooljian, and Paul Steinhauser. We are dissecting the week's news and talking about the state of the state. We're going to move on to other topics, but if you want to weigh in, still time for that. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll bring your comment in a moment when it makes sense. Coming up, we're going to be talking with NHPR's Todd Bookman about accusations that the State Liquor Commission is looking the other way in taking illegal cash sales and possibly not reporting it appropriately to the IRS. We're going to dig into that story with NHPR's Todd Bookman after the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jessica Hunt. I'm a producer for The Exchange. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I'm really excited because I am getting to put together a retrospective about Something Wild. That's another podcast on NHPR. You'll hear it during Morning Edition on Friday mornings. They have been doing that for 20 years, and I am delighted to be able to put together a special episode of The Exchange about Something Wild and their time on the air. But I'm coming to you because I need your help. I need to hear your memories, things that have touched you over the years about Something Wild. Here's the phone number to leave a voicemail, 603-513-7797. Thanks a lot.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with NHPR's Lauren Chulgin, Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Call now to join the conversation about the week's news. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And don't forget, if you're interested in watching what's going on here in the studio, you can watch a live video stream at our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. And joining us now is NHPR's Todd Bookman, who has been reporting on the state's Liquor Commission, which faces stunning accusations of enabling illegal purchases. Todd, thank you very much for being here.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
So Executive Counselor Andrew Walensky came forward with this. What does he say is happening?
Well, he's saying there's something fishy going on in the New Hampshire state-run liquor system. What's happening there may be illegal and that officials may be turning a blind eye to it. So it's well known that people come to New Hampshire for our low, low liquor prices. And what Walensky is contending is that people are coming to New Hampshire. They are making extremely large all-cash purchases, but that they're breaking up those purchases so that they fall under a $10,000 cash threshold, because if you're over that, you have to fill out an IRS form with your name on it. So he says there's two ways that this is being done. People are breaking up their purchases at the register. So a group will go in, they'll buy an extremely large amount of liquor. They will break up that purchase amongst two or three people. Each will pay $9,000 in cash to stay under that $10,000 threshold. He's also saying that people are going from store to store to store, buying $9,000 of liquor at a pop. Both of those ways to sort of structure the transaction so that you fall below $10,000 are violations of federal law. The IRS says you can't do that.
And I mean, help me visualize this. So $9,000 worth of alcohol, is that like a pallet of alcohol?
It's hand trucks full.
Okay.
It's cases and cases and cases.
So super noticeable if someone is leaving the liquor store with this amount of liquor.
You would say, I would say it's noticeable. I don't know. It's not how I usually shop.
it's not? Todd.
I will say what's curious is that a lot of this liquor appears to be Hennessy. Hennessy is a cognac. I haven't had the pleasure of experiencing Hennessy cognac just yet.
It's very tasty.
But it's a very, very popular drink amongst people who prefer to pay in cash, all cash. And what Walensky is contending is that the state liquor system is well aware that people want Hennessy. They are stocking it in extremely large numbers at border liquor stores near the border. And we pulled some numbers on this. The Londonderry Liquor Store, $3,500 bottles of Hennessy in stock, 2,600 in Keene. Meanwhile, in Peterborough, there were 15 bottles, three in Lebanon. And Walensky is alleging that a lot of these bottles are not even on the shelves.
And they're not. I went to the Londonderry one, the one that has 3,000, and there was just six on the shelf. Hmm. So you have to ask. You have to be like, you know, I want cases and cases of Hennessy.
Wow. Right. Okay. So how does Councillor Walensky argue that the state knows about this and that it's sort of making it possible for this to happen.
Well, these are the allegations that he's making. He's saying that based on his own observations of one of these transactions, he watched as a couple split up a large purchase so that they fell under the $10,000 threshold. He said he received whistleblower statements from employees who say they have been instructed, we assume by their higher-ups, to not report any suspicious purchases, B, to not call ahead to other stores and say, hey, we just had somebody buy $9,000 worth of Hennessy. It's probably illegal if you sell them another $9,000. And then there's this third allegation. He is claiming that people are being instructed if they go outside to help load the Hennessy into somebody's trunk or truck to not look, in a sense, to ignore what already may be in the back of that truck, which would signal that somebody has made multiple purchases. Again, these are all allegations that Valinsky is alleging. He submitted them in a five-page memo with accompanying documents earlier this week to the state attorney general and the governor's office.
And are these state law violations or federal law violations or both?
These would not be state law violations. And this is sort of at the heart of what the Liquor Commission's response. There's nothing illegal about selling booze to people. There's nothing illegal about selling $9,000 in booze to people. And it's also sort of, frankly, not in New Hampshire's place to be enforcing other states' laws. So this might be violating New York or Vermont laws when those customers return to those states, either driving through them. It's considered bootlegging in Vermont if you have more than 9 liters in your car. In New York, you can't just resell booze you bought in New Hampshire. There are tax structures in place. New Hampshire would say, it's not our problem. It's not our ability to police this. Valinsky is contending, though, that this gray area of whether or not they're facilitating what would be a violation of federal reporting law, that's sort of at the heart of his argument.
Mm-hmm. So has the IRS commented on this?
Well, we reached out to the IRS because we were told they are well aware, and they did confirm that they, quote, are aware of this scheme. They would not confirm whether or not there's sort of an active investigation. Again, the Liquor Commission, flat out denial. They say that there are policies and procedures in place that as long as the retail store employees are following those policies, there should be no violations of state or federal law. And we should point out they are really critical of Executive Counselor Andrew Valinsky.
How? What have they said?
Well, they believe that his undercover operation, they believe, you know, what they're calling basically a sting, violated several policies. They say it was untoward. They accuse him of turning, you know, the very popular and very lucrative state-run liquor system into this political football. So they categorically reject all these allegations.
Are they saying, like, he was lurking around the liquor stores and watching to see what was happening? Lauren, you're nodding?
Yeah, I mean, he was there for a couple hours to do this investigation. He was, per his memo, tipped off by a whistleblower employee to know when to come and what store to go to. And so the Liquor Commission statement basically alleges that, you know, that was not right of him to do.
Mm-hmm. And Paul Steinhauser, you spoke with Councillor Valinsky recently. What did he have to say about this?
Yeah, I spoke to him just before the show. First of all, great reporting by you guys. If you haven't listened to this report, it's a must. You definitely got to click on the website and listen because it was very engrossing. This is classic Valinsky. You know, this is he was in the private sector. He's one of the top legal attorneys in the state. He's a real keeping them honest kind of guy with the private sector, but also with the government. He continues that role now on the executive council, which is partially that kind of role to make sure the government runs very streamlined. But just as importantly, listen, New Hampshire is only one of 8 states across the entire nation that regulates and controls the sale of liquor. The Liquor Commission here in New Hampshire is a huge moneymaker. It brings a lot of money into the state for programs that this state desperately needs. I think what Valinsky is saying, he's a little concerned that the New Hampshire Liquor Commission could get involved in a lawsuit. There could be some damage to the commission. That's why he's trying to, I guess, in a way, he says, protect it. He also said he hasn't heard yet back yet from the governor or from the AG, but the AG's office has said, right, Todd, that they are investigating?
The governor's office basically told us to talk to the AG's office, and the AG's office said that they're reviewing the documents and they're not ready to comment on it just yet. I mean, and so for people who are asking themselves, why would an executive counselor be so concerned about liquor stores is exactly what Paul's talking about. I mean, I think sometimes we forget that a state-run liquor store means that this is like a cash cow for the state of New Hampshire. I mean, it's a state-run entity. It's a state agency. And so that's why somebody who is a politician, executive counselor, is so interested in making sure there's no illegal activity going on.
Yeah, we're talking about, 158 million dollars a year to the budget? Was that what it was?
$153 million in revenue last year, roughly 6% of the entire budget.
Which is a lot. That's a big percentage if you think about, you know, all the different agencies and all the things going on that a state government is responsible for.
And the commission has really been growing in recent years. If you've been around the state, you've seen a lot of new stores all over the state selling liquor. And it continues, as Lauren said, it's a huge cash cow and it's going to continue. The money is desperately needed. The last thing we need is for the state liquor commission to be dragged into a lawsuit.
We got an email from someone only identifying themselves as Angel of Death. forgive the name, but this person writes, I heard the report about possible cash structuring at New Hampshire liquor stores. Any cashier and manager who knowingly allows the structuring is just as guilty of violating Section 5324 of Title 31, punishable by a fine, prison term of up to 5 years, or both. I am in the banking industry, and this is a serious federal offense. So someone speaking to the grave nature of what's happening here. So listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking recently about a story that just broke yesterday on NHPR about allegations on at the state liquor store, state liquor commission enabling illegal purchases. This is a story that is evolving. We're going to keep following it, but we've got to move on. We got other stuff to talk about this week, especially with Todd Bookman while he's still here, Todd, because you've been covering this story about the woman who won $560 million in the Powerball lottery and is now fighting in court to keep her name from becoming public. Remind us very quickly of what happened. What's going on with this story?
Sure. A woman identified only as Jane Doe hits the January 6th Powerball. I believe it was the seventh largest Powerball jackpot in U.S. history, roughly $560 million. She contends that she follows the directions on the Lottery Commission's website, which say to sign the back of the ticket. So she signs her name to the back of the ticket. She then calls an attorney. The attorney says, I hope you didn't sign the back of the ticket. And that's because the front and back of winning tickets are subject to the state's right to know laws. There is a way that you can structure the transaction, though, by signing the name of a trust to the back of the ticket, and lawyers will help you process this. That way, the trust's name becomes public information. The person it's linked to remains anonymous. And so Jane Doe has filed a legal petition, a state superior court, and she's basically contending, she's requesting two things. First, she wants permission to essentially white out or erase her name from the back of the ticket that will become public and write in the name of a trust. We already know the name of the trust. It's the Good Karma Family Trust of 2018. Billy Shaheen leaked that information, which is interesting. And then second, she's asking that her name, if that isn't granted, simply be exempt from the right to know law. And her lawyers contend the public doesn't really gain anything by having these names public. If we want full transparency within what's happening in the state lottery system, they say there are other ways that we can ensure that the games are being played in a clean manner. And simply throwing her name out there, which is going to subject her to just endless phone calls, scammers, threats of violence, she says it serves no purpose.
Mm-hmm. This is something I keep thinking about with respect to this case. I mean, we keep talking about transparency or not, but the law already allows someone to hide their identity by a trust.
Correct. The thing is, it doesn't say that on the back of the ticket.
Right.
And it doesn't say that on the Lottery Commission's website. You need to call an attorney to learn how to do that. You can also sign the ticket over to a charity. There's a number of ways you can keep your name off the back of the ticket and out of the public's eye. But she's contending, it says sign the back. I signed the back. That may not have been the best advice that you folks gave me, and I think she deserves a second chance.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've done some reading on this, and there literally is a cottage industry growing up around the country as these lottery jackpots become more popular and larger, of lawyers who specialize in figuring out how to deal with all the rules and the possibility of a public knowledge of who you are as an individual. And this is a case where a lawyer could have told the individual to set up the trust first. You know, the part of the problem with the court case is that you're losing interest on that money. I think it's going to be put in a temporary trust so that it doesn't lose any more interest. I think that the lawyers for the jackpot winner argued that having the name publicized would be life-altering, and the state came back and said, winning $500 million is going to be life-altering regardless. But, recent history is littered with people who win these jackpots, and it just ends up being a disaster. They're just hounded relentlessly by scammers, and I think there's an increasing move for people to win a jackpot, take your time, talk to a lawyer, set up a trust, and then maybe claim it a couple months down the road.
So she's able to collect some of the money now, right, Todd?
So there has been an agreement. The two sides have come together and they say, yes, we are going to begin the process of transferring this money, $560 million. You can sort of picture it in the back of a Subaru. You know, they're going to sort of transfer it to her.
Subaru.
Well, it's, yeah, like sure. Cases of Hennessy, right?
Yeah, basically.
Pallet of Hennessy, pallet of money.
All right. You know. So they're going to allow the trust to collect this money, but while the legal case plays out, they're going to keep the winning ticket under seal. So it's not yet public information. Media requests for right to know requests are not going to be granted, as I understand it, until a judge signs off.
Any sense on when? Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, I know this goes without saying, but is this not the wildest story? Like, just one day, this woman wakes up and not that she just win the lottery, but then she just has a slew of legal problems and drama, and just it's fascinating to me.
Is it worth it? I'd love to.
Well,
ask
that's
her.
The question, right? Is that, you know, but when you buy the ticket, you just hope and pray that you're the winner. And then you're like, oh, I didn't know about all this other stuff.
Yeah. Well, NHPR's Todd Bookman, thank you very much for reporting on both of these stories. We'll have you back again to sort of update us because these are certainly not going anywhere anytime soon. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. If you've got questions about the week news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Before the break, let's talk about Scott Pruitt, because he came to New Hampshire this week, and we didn't really get much notice. Did we, Paul? Do you know anything about this?
No, we didn't get a lot of notice at all, and I know you guys at NHPR were all over this story. I was enjoying watching it, so I'm looking a little more.
So Andy Ropeek was working real hard on this one, and I will say the only way that we knew that Scott Pruitt was coming to New Hampshire was because it was at the bottom of a Washington Post story that talked about his flying first class often when making government trips. So obviously that's on the taxpayer dime and is much more expensive than flying coach. And at the very bottom of the story, it mentioned that he was going to come to New Hampshire this week. And so Annie and Casey McDermott were, oh, I didn't know that. And so it wasn't until after he met with the governor that they confirmed to Annie and NHPR that, yes, in fact, he was in the state.
Okay. And Dean?
Yeah, just real quick. Scott Pruitt has been a fairly controversial EPA administrator.
Lightning rod?
Yeah, sure. The Trump budget has proposed cutting 23% of the EPA. Groups in opposition to Pruitt's EPA said that, you know, by him sneaking in, it deprived them of an opportunity to protest or to organize and be heard. And this whole thing with the flying first class, they've spent a lot of money. He says it's a security detail, and it's because he's controversial that there are security issues. But he's not the first Trump cabinet official to have issues with expensive travel bills.
Mm-hmm. The state says the meeting with Pruitt also touched on regulatory pressures on wastewater plants around Great Bay. Sununu wrote to Pruitt about those in January, and a state spokesman says the two agreed the towns need flexibility to find cheaper ways to protect the watershed. And Melissa Paley commented on this. She's from the Conservation Law Foundation.
Sometimes that statement of, we need flexibility is a euphemism for saying we want relief from what they're claiming is, you know, onerous requirements from EPA.
Paul.
Also, they talked about the Coakley landfill, which is a huge issue with the contaminated water over there in the seacoast. And the governor says that that Pruitt was open to the EPA speeding up the process here. That's one of the big arguments, that the EPA is taking forever to deal with this, and the towns have contaminated water. So the governor touting the trip, saying he got a lot out of it. But again, the governor didn't. It was never on his schedule, he said, because the EPA had asked him to stay quiet about it.
And as far as I know, right, he usually has a calendar posted on the EPA website, but this hadn't been updated since like the beginning of February.
Bingo, February 1st.
Yeah, okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We've got one more thing to talk about before the break, really quickly. Lauren Chooljian, lawmakers are considering making anti-harassment training for legislators mandatory. Why? What's behind this bill?
Well, if anyone saw the pictures that were tweeted out of when they hosted a training for lawmakers, the seats were quite empty. There were not a lot of people that showed up. And so the idea here is to try and force those lawmakers to show up. There have been, you know, opinions on both sides. Some that didn't show up say they had other things going on. And also, they already know this stuff. But then the people on the other side say that it's, you know, you're sending a message by showing up that this is something you care about.
Mm-hmm. And is it even possible to force legislators to do something like this? Like, how can you enforce something like this? Can you say you can't vote on legislation unless you take this harassment training?
I don't know.
Dean, what do you think?
I'm not sure what the process would be for enforcing that, you know, whether you could fine or censure or do something. I'm not sure, to be honest.
I just say it was a bad optic with all that's going on right now. It was not a very good optic.
Not a very good optic. Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Paul Steinhauser, political reporter, NHPR's Lauren Chooljian, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the race for governor in 2018, who's in, who's not. We learned a little bit about that this week. Also, Senate Bill 500, which has inspired one lawmaker to never, ever introduce legislation about guns again. We'll find out why. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Some say love is in the air, but maybe it's time to say goodbye to your old ride. If you've been wanting to break up with your car or truck, why not donate it to NHPR? We'll turn it into the programs you love, like Morning Edition, Fresh Air, and All Things Considered. We'll even send you a $50 Visa gift card as our thanks. Breaking up is really not hard to do. Just go to nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, NHPR's Lauren Chooljian, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Give us a call to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And remember, you can watch a live video stream of us in the studio here at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. So let's talk a little bit about, first, I actually want to bring in a caller who has a question or comment about the lottery winner. It's Dennis in Concord. Dennis, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your question or comment?
Yesterday, Thursday, I literally went to the lottery office up off of Manchester Street on Tegra Drive and grabbed one of each lottery game available ticket, of each and every one. And on the back, under how to claim, number one says, sign the back of your ticket in the space provided to protect your rights. Gave it to the young lady at the window and asked her to deliver this to management. This is their doing. They even on TV pieces tell you, sign the back. They don't ever forewarn you, uh-oh, if it's a large prize, you may not want to do that. But this is their own doing. They need to stop this garbage and allow this party to remain anonymous.
All right. Well, Dennis, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. This is certainly a story that's going to continue to be in the news until the court decides on that. Thanks very much for sharing your thoughts. Listeners, if you want to weigh in on any story you heard this week, if you have questions for our panel, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Lauren Chooljian, you were reporting this week on a bill known as SB 500, a gun bill that has stirred up a lot of controversy in and out of the State House. Tell us about it.
Sure. So the sponsor is Senator Kevin Avard. And the idea behind it in his telling is that it wasn't supposed to be a controversial thing. He was a big player in the concealed carry bill that was passed last year. And he said a lot of gun groups had come up to him and say there's a lot of cleanup that needs to be done in other gun laws to make it match up with both the concealed carry law and also with federal laws. So he, you know, drafts this kind of wonky piece of legislation about, switching language and all this. And lo and behold, it was very controversial. And in fact, attracted flyers being sent around his district from another pro-gun group, calling him a sleazy politician, calling him pro-gun, linking to him to, quote, the whims of California politicians like Nancy Pelosi. So Kevin Avard at this point, when we had the hearing this week, is just exasperated and exhausted. And here's a little of what he had to say.
Madam Chair, I'm befuddled over this type of nonsense. I'm not out after anybody's guns. We're only trying to protect the citizens of this state.
worth including the sigh there.
I did think I had to keep that in there. I mean, it really, this is when I talked to him on the phone, this is the same thing that he authentically felt like, I'm just trying to help people out here. I'm just trying to clean up the language. This was just supposed to be a cleanup bill. But the mailers were sent out from the New Hampshire Firearms Coalition, which is also a pro-gun group. And the reason I've been so interested in this is because I think sometimes we think if people are advocates for the Second Amendment, if they're pro-gun, they're all in this together, right? I mean, these are the same people who worked together last year to pass concealed carry. But actually, there's a rift going on among some of them. And this bill kind of shows the open wounds, so to speak, that are going on between them. And so Kevin Avard, when he was up at the hearing, asked for a public apology for these mailers because they were really upsetting to him. And the president of the New Hampshire Firearms Coalition, Alan Rice, came to speak and was not going to give that apology.
We stand by what we mailed into Senator Avard's district. We believe it was accurate and correct, and I will not apologize for it. In fact, I'll do it again if I feel it's appropriate.
If it's appropriate to link Kevin Avard to Nancy Pelosi.
Exactly. And so their argument with the New Hampshire Firearms Coalition and a lot of members and their allies, they basically say they don't want federal laws tied up with state laws because in their mind, it restricts, you know, accessories to guns or different types of firearms that they say aren't restricted in state law. I mean, the whole thing is just so interesting to me.
And Paul?
It's fascinating, too, because Kevin Avard is one of the most conservative members of the state Senate. He was a huge supporter, one of the top surrogates back in 2016 for Rand Paul when he ran for president. Yeah, so to tie him to Nancy Pelosi, I find amusing. The other thing, though, and Lauren brings up a really good point, is there is a little bit of a split here. And it's not just over this bill. There's also a bill right now making its way through the state house that would prevent towns and cities from making any gun laws of their own, any firearms laws of their own. And that's splitting the gun lobby here in the state.
Mm-hmm. And the last line of your story, Lauren, where Kevin Avard just said he's not going to introduce gun legislation.
Yeah, this
anymore.
Was before the hearing. He just came up to me to introduce himself and then said, you know, this, I'm just not going to do this anymore because of all the pushback that he got from someone who, you know, from, you know, on paper would look like to be his ally. And 1749, as Paul was saying, is another great example where there are pro-gun groups like Pro-Gun New Hampshire, which is former Senator Bob Clegg is involved in that. There's the Women's Defense League, which is a women's gun group. You know, they're all on the other side. And it's just really interesting to watch.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Send us an email to weigh in on this or other stories you heard this week. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Also in the news this week, Colin Van Ostern, Democratic candidate for governor who lost to Chris Sununu last time around, has decided to opt out of the race this year. He never got in. He says he's not going to. Dean, were Democrats sort of waiting to see what Van Ostern would do?
I don't sense this is a big surprise to anyone. I think to some extent, particularly Steve Marchand, who's the only announced candidate, was interested to see what Van Ostern was going to do. But, you know, I think part of the issue is we have a two-year term for governor. So if you are going to run an election, you basically have to start running almost immediately after just finishing the last election. He only lost to Sununu by about 16,000 votes, very close margin for a gubernatorial race here in the state. He's got a young family. He's probably a little bit burnt out, needs to recharge. I don't think we've seen the last of him in terms of running for elective office. He's also, you know, Colin, before working for SNHU, was had a long history as a campaign a strategist. And so he's pretty good at assessing the relative vulnerability of the current governor. And he just may have decided this is not his time to jump back in. But I think a lot of it is just we have such a compressed cycle here because of the two-year terms that it's really hard to come back after a long, hard run from the last election.
Paul Steinhauser.
Not a surprise, but a lot of Democrats were waiting for this announcement, and this may now, kind of set off a chain reaction here. Listen, Van Ostern was very politically involved last year in the special elections for the Kavanaugh state Senate seat, really helping in the Manchester group mayoral race, so he was very involved. He was seriously considering this again. He only lost by 16,000 votes to Sununu back in 16. Now with him out, though, take a look at Molly Kelly, the former state senator from the Monadnock region. She's just outside of Keene. She is seriously looking at this. She could have the backing of Emily's List and some other major groups. Also, keep your eyes on Mark Connolly, who ran in 16. And even keep your eyes on State Senator Dan Feltes and former Congressman Paul Hodes. They're also considering it. But I think Molly Kelly, of all those, is the one that's most serious to get in there. Marshawn is pretty happy about this now. You know, he's been out there since April. He's tied in a lot of support and a lot of fundraising. So without Van Ostern in there, it helps Marshawn.
Let's talk about CD1, because we learned, thanks to some reporting at NHPR, Casey McDermott was doing this, that there's significant money there, and Maura Sullivan apparently seems to be getting a lot of it. Lauren?
Yeah, if anyone's interested in campaign finance or also just this really interesting race in general, they should definitely head over to our website. Casey laid it out in a really beautifully color-coded way that really helps you understand not just how much money is being raised right now, but also where it's coming from, which early on in a campaign like this, this is just the beginning of the money that we'll be seeing, but it really helps to know kind of where people's support is coming from. And for example, you know, we saw that Maura Sullivan is leading by a lot of money. She has almost like, you know, $400,000 that she's raised. But a lot of it comes from, that she reported, from out-of-state individual donations, you know, all over, people as famous as Sheryl Sandberg, you know, people from Boston, people from New York, you know, they're coming from all over. But the campaign has said that they did also get smaller donations from people from New Hampshire. They just don't have to report that right away. But like I say, it's still very early, but it's certainly interesting to watch.
And Lauren, you were in Illinois before you were here in New Hampshire, and that's where Maura Sullivan spent some time. Did her name ever come up?
Yeah, so when I first took this job and had heard that she was running for Congress here, I was like, why does that name sound familiar? And because she's from Illinois and had considered running in the 6th District where Peter Roskam, a Republican, currently serves. And she was on the list of a lot of people. That's another district that is just full of candidates on that side. And so, yeah, her name had come up. And I know Paul has also done some reporting on this as well.
Yeah, Paul, what do you have to say?
Well, here's also the big picture here. The first district is one of the best. No, it is the best swing district in the country. It is the best U.S. House race in the country. This district is ping-pong back and forth between Democrats and Republicans the last four elections. And for the first time in 16 years, there's no incumbent running for re-election. Carol Shea Porter, the four-term Democrat, has said she's not running for re-election. That's why we care about this district. It gets a ton of national money. Yeah, Sullivan, I spoke to her earlier this week for Seacoast Online, and she did admit that she considered it. People, she said, had asked her to run in Illinois, her native state. She wasn't living there anymore, but we're talking about a time frame of right after the 2016 election and just a few months before she moved up here. Why is this important? Because a lot of people are criticizing her as a carpetbagger, that she moved up here last July, they say, to run for Congress. She told me, no, that's not the case. We came up here for personal decisions.
And we have some tape of Maura Sullivan talking about that, how she considered moving elsewhere to raise a family, but had fallen in love with Portsmouth.
I love the state of New Hampshire. I've loved it since I came here when I was a kid. And I wanted to raise a family here. And so if I'd moved anywhere else, I would have given up my dream of doing that.
Moving to Portsmouth because it's a great place to raise a family. That's Maura Sullivan. So we're going to keep following the CD1 race as it evolves. Dean, did you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, a lot is being made about all the outside money coming into the state for Sullivan and others. And I did a study with Dartmouth colleagues back in the 90s in which we looked at this issue. I think it was the 98 midterm election and found that there was not a lot of outside money in New Hampshire. But since then, we've had a couple of Supreme Court decisions. The money environment has changed. House races in general tend to be more nationalized. It's just the way things are now. There's just always lots of money. These national groups and the national parties look at where the key races are, and they pour tons of money into the state. So this idea of, you know, in-state money, out-state money, it's really not something that makes that much of a difference anymore, because all important races are going to have a lot of outside money. It's the nature of the campaign finance environment we have now.
Right, and what makes the difference is how the voters feel about this, right? I mean, that's the whole point. And so I've started talking to voters, Democratic voters, about, you know, does this matter to you that she's not from here and that she just moved here? And it's really split. I mean, some people say, you know, we saw this with Scott Brown and we were on the other side. We, you know, he just moved here to run here and we were upset about that. But other people say, you know, she sells her story really well. She feels like this is authentically where she wanted to raise her family. So what do I care? She's a good candidate on paper. She seems like she would be good. So some voters don't care. And I think, you know, her resume is, you know, an ideal Democratic resume right now for the larger party. The party is split between, you know, do we go bolder? Do we go more left? Do we go more Bernie Sanders? Or do we try to get the middle of those independents or those conservatives who are, you know, not satisfied with Donald Trump? And her military background is something I know the larger party is interested in. So, you know, but it all comes down to what the voters decide.
And Paul?
eye-popping number, $430,000, was a huge haul, a lot more than Chris Pappas, who was considered the early favorite and the best-known candidate in the race. That's why we're spending so much time on her. And as Lauren said, yeah, she's got it's almost right out of central casting. She was a Marine, served in Fallujah, served in the Pentagon and the VA under the Obama administration. I tell you, though, it's a fascinating race on both sides. It's also splitting the Bernie coalition here in the state because they're now divided among three candidates, Pappas, Mark McKenzie, and Mindy Mesmer. So it is a great story. We're going to be talking about it straight to November.
Okay, well, let's talk about another story before the end of the hour, and that is that the New Hampshire Senate Education Committee heard testimony on a bill this week that would make certain adult education programs available only to legal residents of the state. Lauren, you're not familiar with this? Paul, how about you? Who's arguing for this bill?
I'll be honest. I'm sorry. On this one, I haven't been covering it.
Yeah, this was introduced by Andy Sanborn, is the conservative senator. The state senate is the primary sponsor here, but there are others as well. And his argument is that if there are people who are here illegally, the state should not be funding adult workforce training for those individuals because they're not legally technically. Here technically, and they shouldn't be allowed to work in the state. So why fund them? The concern here is some people have expressed is that it's very difficult to separate out workforce training from other kinds of adult education, like English as a second language courses that give people who are here basic learning classes, and so that's the concern that in practice. It's very difficult to separate out the kinds of workforce training that Sanborn's talking about from these other services and adult education courses that are very important to new immigrants, whether they're here legally or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one more story really important to get to by the end of the hour. That is the legal age by which someone can purchase tobacco. There was a push to sort of raise that age, but Paul, that seems to be dead in the legislature.
Yeah, big setback last night in the state Senate. This bill would raise the age from 18 to 21. The idea here is to cut back on teen smoking. It was pushed by a bunch of teens from the Seacoast region and a group called Dover Youth to Youth, but it was tabled by the state Senate. They're confident those supporters of this bill are going to get it done next year because New Hampshire is now almost surrounded by states that have raised that age to 21.
Wow, okay. Show's about to wrap up. Let's ask each of you, starting with you, Lauren, what you're going to be covering in the next week.
I think I'm going to keep watching the CD1 race. It's really interesting to me. I really like seeing what kinds of voters are already out and about going to events and trying to get to know these candidates. I think it's a really good way to get to know the district, being, from here but moved away and get back. So that's one. And then this gun debate. I mean, and where else these kind of fissures are happening between pro-gun groups is really interesting to me.
Okay. How about you, Paul?
Some big votes at the State House on the campaign trail. We've got another 2020 visitor next week. That's Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State. He's making another trip to New Hampshire. More speculation there, of course, for the race for the White House.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Paul. And Dean?
And Julian Castro, former Secretary of HUD under Obama, former mayor of San Antonio. We've heard of the famous Castro brothers. His brother is a member of Congress. He's here as well, talking, I think, young Democrats today. And as Paul said, more coming up next week. Yeah, it's a midterm election year, so I think things are really going to start to accelerate into the spring.
All right. Well, thank you all very, very much for being here for the roundup.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's Lauren Chulgin, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. And you can find a link to their reporting and other stories mentioned in the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup at our website, nhpr.org. And remember, the conversation about the stories continues online at nhpr.org and on our Facebook page. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.